Hi, this is Kevin Richards coming back from the University of Illinois with another segment of Going Behind the Research. This time, we're going to be talking to Jen Jacobs and Zach Wall-Alexander from Northern Illinois University. We're going to be talking broadly about a project that they've been involved with for several years now called Project Flex. But we are still going to do what we usually do and link an article in the show notes. And so Jen and Zach have shared the paper that's titled Physical Activity and Social Behaviors of Incarcerated Youth Participating in a Sport Leadership Program. That is coming out in the Journal of Correctional Healthcare. It is currently in press, and we'll get the version that gets posted online posted to the show notes. But just as a reminder, rather than providing a forum to discuss research that is conducted in health and physical education, the Going Behind the Research segment focuses on telling the stories that surround research that we read in scholarly journals. Globally, the segment aims to humanize research by providing a forum to discuss the motives that draw researchers towards topics and studies, challenges and successes experienced along the way, and lessons learned that transcend individual journal publications and impact future research decisions. Each episode will feature an interview with one or more members of an authorship team to discuss the stories behind a selected publication or broader project. And we'll include a brief overview of the project, and then we'll follow a relatively common interview guide that asks questions. But as you've probably been able to tell if you've listened to previous episodes, sometimes we get to all of those questions, sometimes we don't. So with that, I'm really excited to welcome Jen and Zach to talk about their work with us today. Could you both introduce yourselves?
My name is Zach Wall. I'm an associate professor in sport pedagogy at Northern Illinois University.
Hey, Kevin and everyone. I am Jen Jacobs. I'm also at NIU with Zach. I'm an associate professor in the area of sports psychology, and we are pumped to be here.
Awesome. Really happy to welcome you both. I worked at Northern Illinois for a year. It was one of the best years of my academic career. That it was a visiting assistant professorship year, really formative time, and got to know Jen while I was there and Zach afterwards. So this kind of feels like, I don't know, what would it be, circa 2014?
Yeah.
You muted yourself there, buddy.
Myself, I know. And it's funny because we also like sort of crossed paths as well when you came down to Alabama that year when you were interviewing. I was a doc student, and then we live swapped a little bit because I took your apartment here, and then you went down to Alabama. So it was I'd tell you more like, but the circuit is more like serendipitous, I'd say.
It was. In fact, I actually moved into the office that you had been working in before you finished at Alabama. So really cool connections. And I had the honor and pleasure of working with Jen on her dissertation committee. And we've remained really good friends and collaborators since. So really cool to host you both today. So without any further ado, let's start broad. This episode might end up going a little bit differently because I think we're going to talk more about Project Flex as a broad concept and a broader project rather than focusing on an individual publication. But why don't we start broad and if you could, Jen, just talk to us a little bit about Project Flex, maybe a little bit of the history, how it started and how it's become kind of this line of inquiry and a passion for you.
Absolutely. So Project Flex is a sport leadership program in a space that you probably don't see in the physical activity realm often. It is in youth prisons outside of Chicagoland. So we work with incarcerated youth running what started out as what looked like a sort of after school program. Of course, it is in the confines of a prison setting, so it looks quite different, which we'll get into. But over the past 5 years that we've been doing this has evolved into being more of a mentorship program, still through the realm of sport, physical activity, and fitness. It's morphed into being sort of a college readiness experience as well, where we're getting youth opportunities to visit college campuses and start to envision a possible future in higher education. It's it's morphed into some sports specific programs. So dabbling in a basketball program and a pickleball program, which is extremely exciting to me because that's been a passion in my life. But generally the thread that's remained throughout is that we're trying to provide youth the opportunity to sort of reimagine what their possible futures could look like, using sport as the hook. Sport is the thing that helps us connect. And sort of one of the philosophies of our program is congruent with sort of the field of sport-based leadership, and that's building strong relationships. So while Zach and I started the program 5 years ago, we quickly figured out two older, white, like nerdy professors are really not the play to go in and try to help, you know, kids think differently about different paths in their lives. So we assembled this superstar squad of graduate students who live and breathe this program and sport and mentoring, and just do that amazing on the ground work, working with these kids from really tough backgrounds.
That's fantastic. Go ahead, Zach. Sorry. Yep.
To jump in a little bit. So we started this program 5 years ago. And when we started, we were working with one graduate student and we were working in one facility and really just working with about 10 or 15% of that population in that facility. And then over the last 5 years, we've actually expanded to three of the five facilities within the state, which has been really fun too. It shows that, you know, the state is really trusted in us and really trusted in the program and kind of the work that we're doing. So with that, we've grown to fund 9 graduate students over the course of these 5 years. So we're currently funding 9 students. And then, you know, kind of like our exposure within the facilities has grown quite a bit as well. So it really started with only really working with about 10 to 15%. And now our exposure in some of the facilities upward of like 80, 90% of working with the kids within the facility. And some of that is because the facilities have decreased the amount of youth within the setting, but also a lot of it is just we've ramped up our programming and the different things that we have to offer.
Yeah, that's really interesting and fantastic to hear about how what started as kind of a smaller project has blossomed and grown into a huge endeavor. You know, one thing that people might be thinking as they're listening to that, I know that I am, is where does the money come from to fund all of those students? I mean, it's wonderful just to be able to fund 9 students for their education is fantastic. You know, on top of all of the great work that y'all are doing, does that money come from the state?
Yeah, so we can answer that a couple of different ways. In the very early years, that money came from nowhere, and it came from sort of volunteering and being creative with honoring like course credit to students. We were fortunate, NIU has provided us with some assistantships, or we've applied for assistantship opportunities with NIU that we've been able to support our graduate students with. NIU is awesome at supporting, especially students from marginalized backgrounds. And that happens to be a coincidence of who tends to be a great fit for positions like this. So we have gotten some support from NIU, but by year 2 or 3, the state, the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, started to get wind of kind of the reach of our program, and the feedback from the kids and the staff was so abundantly good that they're like, oh yeah, let's bring you on as a partner. So now we have state funding that helps support our program, and then as well as some private donors, and we're looking into getting corporate donors and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's really cool, and it just shows that sometimes if you're willing to kind of plant the seeds and get creative during those first few years, because you know it can be difficult to do things without funding, but starting on a small scale, it seems like that happens a bit. So if you're willing to kind of put in that extra work, plant those seeds, then things can really grow into broader projects that are well received and well resourced. So. Really cool to hear about that. You talked about pickleball in the middle there. I played pickleball a couple weekends ago, and I thought of you. I was up in Iowa and played with a group of like probably 60 plus, and they made me look pretty bad.
that tends to happen, but I feel like I'm doing my job if in this sort of small world of kinesiology, physical education, people hear pickleball and think of Jen Jacobs, then I think I'm happy with that.
Yep, there you go.
it's funny because Jen, like, pickleball has become extremely popular more recently, but to be fair, she has really been on the pickleball bandwagon for a couple of years now. And when she first told me about it, I did laugh because, you know, my first inclination was people over the age of 50 and 60 playing. And I ended up giving her a hard time about it. But then I actually played this 2 summers ago at camp, and really enjoyed it and felt a little bad that I had to eat some of my words. But it's been fun to play it with her and then also to implement it. It's actually taken shape. The youth in the facility are really into it and excited about it. And it speaks more honestly towards, because typically, you know, in that setting, basketball and kind of like football rule the day, but it really speaks to the youth. If the instructor is excited and passionate about something, that excitement and passion really integrates and assimilates into the youth, but also just like the relationships. You know, I mean, like Dr. Jacobs or Jan or whatever we're calling her here, she kind of ran a pickleball program that with youth that she had really strong relationships with. And she basically was like, listen, like, this is going to be awesome. Just trust me a little bit. And they did. And it's really blossomed. And it's been really successful.
That's super cool. I appreciate you guys sharing a little bit of that background. Let's kind of narrow down the focus of the conversation a little bit. Maybe Zach will start this question with you. You know, the specific article that we're using as the anchor point for this study, could you talk to us just about that for a few minutes, perhaps as, you know, as an example of some of the types of research that you do with the project?
Yeah, so I can kind of speak to that paper specifically, but more broadly, we look at a couple of different areas specific to the youth that we're working with. So one of the things that we're looking at is physical activity levels and MVPA within programming, just to see, like, are these youth getting physical activity? Because unfortunately, the youth are so sedentary within these populations. So the research is showing that the youth are getting anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 steps in an entire day, which is extremely alarming, especially since CDC wants them to get anywhere from 10 to 12,000 steps. So we were looking at that. And kind of like as we've expanded, we've started to shift some of our research to look at the specific teacher behaviors as well and like look at how they're implementing programming. But then also it's more of like the qualitative stuff. So looking at life skill transfer, we're looking at some of the other things that we're doing specific to the college readiness program. But specific to the paper that we sent in, basically what the purpose of that paper was is we were looking to look at the physical activity levels within programming. But the other kind of key to this was looking at the social behaviors of the youth that were incarcerated during our what we call like a flex session, which is more of like our structured sports leadership program. So essentially we were looking at about 23 participants that were enrolled in programming. And what we did was we used SOCART to code both the physical activity levels but also the social behaviors that they had. So from a physical activity standpoint, what we found is that we were hitting about 51% moderate to vigorous physical activity throughout programming, which is like kind of that gold standard specific to physical education. So that's obviously a positive thing that we were able to do. But the other probably more beneficial finding that we found that was very interesting to us was we were looking at the amount of pro-social physical and also a pro-social non-physical behaviors. And what we were finding was there is anywhere from like 15 to 17 like interactions that were positive within a 45 to 50 minute session, which is like, it's something if you're not like familiar with the research, it might be like, is that a lot? Is that terrible? But what we found is that was double or triple the amount of typical elementary, middle school, and high school recess and unstructured times. So you were having way more positive interactions youth to youth and youth to instructor than what's typically seen within other settings that are like similar sport settings.
Yeah.
So that's the first. The second is, which is interesting, is we also had a pretty low amount of like the antisocial, which is more of like those negative responses that were both social and physical. We had essentially on par with the amount of the verbal negative behaviors, but actually less physical negative behaviors within this jail setting. And to kind of paint the picture of what this jail setting looks like is we're working in where this study took place was a maximum security juvenile detention center in the state of Illinois. So essentially, roughly half of the youth that we work with were in for murder. So we're not looking at like petty theft and those types of things. So that finding is really interesting. And then the other finding that was fairly on par with the literature was that about 2% of these like negative behaviors were ignored by the youth within the facility, which again, so something negative would happen to a youth and they would choose to ignore it and not respond to it. And that's actually a touch higher than what you see with elementary school students, middle school students as well. So what we found and what we're excited about is that the life skills that we're introducing and teaching, the youth are actually taking those skills, but then implementing it within programming. And yeah, we're actually, again, according to this study, is we're seeing more positive behaviors within programming than is typically in those unstructured times, but then also less of those negative behaviors, which is exciting for us.
Yeah, yeah, that's excellent, Zach. You know, I guess maybe a follow-up question that Jen, I might throw to you before we were started to record and we talked about kind of data related to this project and the things that you're doing from a research perspective more generally, you mentioned qualitative data and interviews. And so I was just wondering if you wanted to kind of paint the picture of what that's looked like, what other forms of data that you've worked with in this setting beyond the quantitative survey data that we saw in this particular study.
Absolutely. Yeah, I am involved in a lot of the qualitative work, and something we've learned along the way, actually, we learned this pretty quickly, and this is just a nature of the population we're working with. We figured out that we have to be really sensitive and careful about the interview process. Mm-hmm. Because there's this power differential, and the whole idea of asking questions as friendly and informative as we mean them to be may naturally feel like the youth as interrogation. And unfortunately, this is a population that's been persecuted is maybe a strong word, but I'm going to use it here through like interrogation techniques from kind of our police forces, whether they were warranted or not. But that's just sort of a traumatic thing that they have in their background. And so because of the power differential, because of some of like the sociological factors of our age and gender and race and education level, we figured out quickly that if not done tactfully, that sort of question and answer process that's really traditional to research doesn't work well and or can be harmful. Yeah. So we've tried to be creative with how to like elevate their voices in a way that doesn't feel like question, answer. And that besides the point is something that's really difficult with like teenagers in general anyways. So if you kind of compound that with their traumatic backgrounds, it's tough. So a couple of projects that we're really proud of. Recently, this one is in press right now. Recently, we did a study on the meaning of sport throughout their lives. And we used it through the lens of critical race theory because nearly all of the youth that we work with are youth of color. And we had them tell stories about sport memories throughout their life to try to understand how they conceptualize what sport is presently. And that gives us kind of insider information on how to keep using that as hopefully a positive tool in their lives. Mm-hmm. But we sort of used a narrative approach there. And then a study that we've got on the docket that we're really, really pumped for, that's going to be led by our PhD student, Gabrielle Bennett, is going to be asking them to identify turning point moments in their life. Turning points being like, I had a fork in the road and I chose this path instead of this path. And presumably that led to some negative consequences related to being convicted of crimes or involved in gang life. And so we're going to ask them about those moments, but then in a like a series interview approach, in another interview, we're going to ask them to rewrite those moments and reconceptualize what they could have had for their future should they have taken a different route. So I think the philosophy there that our research team tries to kind of stick to is that we're selecting research methods, one, that are prioritizing the individual's well-being above all, but two, like still looking for opportunities to have them like learn something about themselves, possibly strengthen our relationship with them in the process. Like those are opportunities there that we feel just are worth it.
And that actually transitions really well into the next question that I was going to ask. You started, you know, talking about methods a little bit, and this is well outside of my area of comfort, but I do know that working with incarcerated individuals in a general sense has some added levels of complexity for good reason, because researchers have in the past abused and taken advantage of incarcerated individuals. When you add on that you're working with incarcerated youth, I would assume that that's created a context that has been very fruitful for you in terms of learning about new ways of conducting research and approaching your methods. So just kind of expanding upon the methodological considerations that you already raised through Project Flex and the associated research, what have you learned from a methods perspective?
The first thing I think we should talk through, because I think I wonder if anyone's interested or wondering about this, is the IRB process.
Sure.
So we went through the review board process here at NIU, and we anticipated that it was going to be a pretty lengthy and burdensome process. And it was definitely lengthy, but I will say that in terms of like the nice thing about it was the people that were on the board, they were really vested in making sure that the youth were going to be protected. And there was at no point in the process, and this was around a 7 or 8 month process for us, which some might think that's long, some might think it's short. But at no point in the process did I not feel that the people on the board were not looking out for the betterment of the youth. So one example that I can give is that an example of this is we were going to have the youth do journaling and journal about their experiences within Project Flex, journal about their experiences in their home life. And that we were going to use that as a research tool, but we were also going to use that as a tool to just build relationships. Because when we started, we really, you know, obviously we'd never interacted with the youth, and we were going to take that as like a relationship building. We were going to do something similar to give to the youth as well. And one of the pushback that we got about it was, what if they were to write something in there about a guard or about their experience within the facility, and then someone within the facility would be privy to that information? They might be treated negatively, which we in no meant even thought about that. But as soon as we heard it, we're like, of course, like the last thing we want is to cause these kids any harm. So it was something that was really cool, because it provided the university did a great job of providing more insight into us and made it forced us to kind of look at it more holistically on what we're doing to make sure that we're protecting the youth in all facets. So I think that's something that I think is really, is a cool process. And I think besides it taking a long period of time, it was really interesting to see that the university was pro what we were doing, because I think they saw a lot of the benefits in what we were doing. Jenna, it looks like you have.
Yeah, I'll just mention sort of a really big picture lesson that we learned in the research process has been that we're just not going to do rigorous research. Like the idea of rigor, what we've learned in our doc courses and what we're taught is our best practices in research to get the most rigorous research, that right now that's just not feasible in a prison setting. Anything from like participants not showing up on days that they have no control over, we have no control over, or imagine like just having to lose complete contact with a participant. When they get released, we don't know that. Sometimes they don't know that. So we'll invest a lot into having them as a participant, and then they're gone, and then we can't do follow-ups, or so we just have to drop that. The kind of volatility of the environment is just take like an open school environment times 10. So we've just sort of figured out like, nope, we're not going to have super rigorous research. It's going to take longer always than we need to. I think Zach will even mention in this study, there were numerous observations we had to do, and we thought, okay, that'll probably take 2 months. And I think it took 4 or 5. And that's just what we've put up with as part of action-based research and working with this group.
Well, and along those lines, if you don't mind me interjecting real quick, Zach, I wonder, and I'll pose it as a question. I wonder whether or not it's not the fact that the research being done is not rigorous, but that the concept of rigor is relative. at least in part to the environment that it's being done in. And there are certain things that are possible and advisable in other environments, in some environments. And in other environments, doing those things is not possible and definitely not advisable.
Yeah, I think, Kevin, I think you nailed it. I can give you a couple examples of that as well. But I think just looking at when we started to, before we even looked into doing any research, we were just kind of diving into the literature. And a lot of the physical activity or the fitness data that's out there, or even the interviews for that matter, the end might be three participants. And I think, like you said, it's just some of the instruments or the tools that you think might be normal part of, for example, doing interviews are just not feasible. Like, so for example, the first 3 years that we were in the facility, we were not allowed to bring a recording device into the facility. So we would have to transcribe everything by hand. So imagine, like, you know, we've been working with some of the kids, you know, just picture 2 or 3 years in, we've been working with some of these kids for 2 or 3 years. So there is a relationship there, a pretty strong relationship, but at the same time, like, to give more context on like what this looks like for, you know, I think Jen described this as like nerdy. So I'm going to say slightly cool. I don't know about nerdy. We're definitely not cool, but I don't know about nerdy. But so again, so there was a youth that we'd known for several years, and we were talking about kind of like about race, and he was like, you know, I hate white people. I hate all white people. And he was telling me this, and I'm like, all right, like, that's cool. Like, what, you don't hate me. Like, we have a good relationship. So you can't hate every white person. He's like, no, like, you're different. And I'm like, okay, like, why do you hate white people? Like, what's, you know, like, where does this come from? And he's like, well, like, my grandma or my grandfather died. Like, a white person killed my grandpa. Like, a white person killed my dad. And I'm like, okay, well, that makes sense. I can see like where that might come from. But even if you think about from an interview process, if you're interviewing somebody, that there's a relationship there, but there's not full trust. Like, there's just never going to be full trust. And it's even, and that's in any environment, but even in this environment, more so, these kids, the youth are just so guarded, especially, and a lot of times from, you know, white males or white females. So if we're trying to write notes when people are taking, you know, making statements, and they say something that like is like, you know, a little bit more touchy about a murder or a crime, and we're like vigorously trying to write things down so we can capture it, that's going to ruin the flow of an interview. And it's also, you know, that kid, I've seen it so many times where we're taking notes and he's looking at us writing, and he essentially like changes what he, not changes what he's saying, but he loses the flow because he's like, well, shit, I don't know what he's writing right now.
Yep.
So that's something that just, it completely changed the research process for us. And it, again, it almost a lot, it's like, what's feasible, what's not. Another easy example, more in the context of like this study, is with systematic observation, typically you're going to film everything that's done. You can't bring in any technology, so there's no filming. So everything is live coded. And then, you know, same thing with, it took us about 3 years to get accelerometers within the facility. And even now that we have to check them in, check them out per youth. And they disassembled the accelerometer to make sure that they can't use it as a shank. So these are the types of things that we're going through with even something as basic and simple as like a small little accelerometer.
Yeah, that's those are fantastic examples. It really brings it to life and shows, you know, all the considerations that you need to take into account. And I think it also kind of transitions into, you know, the next question that I was going to throw out to both of you, which is just kind of talking a little bit about the background behind this work, the trajectory that it's set you on, and how it's kind of become, you know, part of your scholarly identity. When I think about the two of you now, one of the first things I think about, if I was asked to describe your work to somebody else, other things would come to mind, of course, but one of those core things would be Project Flex. Knowing both of you, going back to when you were doctoral students, when all three of us were doctoral students, I don't know that that was necessarily where you saw things going at that point. So how did you get here, and how has being here shaped where will you go next?
Now, when you're asking the question my parents ask me is, why does my daughter work in a jail? Like, why is she devoting her life to this? But I think that you're accurately capturing it. Zach and I both had our passion areas, Zach with sport education and me with sort of after school, sport-based youth development, summer camps. Like, we had our different routes, and that was like, yep, this is what we're hanging our hat on. And then truthfully, this program started as a like, hey, we should collaborate on something. What do you like? What do I like? Let's find something that overlaps. And I have a background working with gang affiliated youth in Chicago, and Zach worked with incarcerated female populations during his PhD at Alabama. He was teaching physical education to young women. And we kind of identified, yeah, we really are drawn to those sort of forgotten, isolated populations. And so this started as, truthfully, a cold call to a local prison. And it was not meant to be a research agenda. It was meant to be service and give back, and let's see what we can do. But as Zach mentioned, as we started to get in there and find that there was just this mutual need on their end and then on our end to like kind of like hone our skills in a different setting, that's when we started to dive into the research and see, as Zach said, there is little to none. You know, there's going to be a paper coming out soon by our team and a researcher from University of Delaware. It's just kind of a scoping review on all the work that's been done in the area of criminal justice and physical activity. And there's maybe 40-ish studies total, 30-ish studies total. And that includes adult populations, and that's mostly adult populations. And this is like in the history of research. And then in terms of university prison partnerships, to our knowledge, there's just one, and you're speaking with them. And then there are just fewer studies even looking at youth populations at all. And so part of it is, wow, we have an opportunity to really kind of change the course of what is known about this area. But then part of it was, we need to learn about this area if we're going to keep, you know, running this program effectively. So a lot of the research that we're doing is actually out of necessity to help dictate how can we keep making an impact with these individuals in a way that is showing up in evidence-based form.
Well, and I like the way that you describe that, Jen, because that kind of brings together the intersection of research and practice, right? So it's you're doing this work, it's service, it's also probably a teaching focus in a way now, because you have those graduate students who are working with you, and then you're collecting the data. So you're kind of hitting this trifecta and doing it in a way that I think you're right. I think it's quite unique. You know, I brag on you guys sometimes when I hear about cool things happening and I want to contribute to the conversation. It's almost like, yeah, well, have you heard about this? Because this is really unique and innovative.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're running a little bit short on time. So I've got one last question and then maybe something fun we could do for a minute. So that last question, and I understand that you may need to be picky, choosy, or censored in how you respond to this, given the population that you work with and the need to protect them. But do you have any stories accompanying the process of completing this investigation, working with Project Flex, that you feel comfortable sharing, that give us a look under the hood, and bonus points if you can make us laugh?
Okay. Well, okay. So I'll give you just a couple of stories that come to mind. I think one of them is just, and this is not the one to make you laugh, so don't judge me based on this first one.
Sure.
But the first, so with systematic observation, you know, it's a lot of coding and circling things on a piece of paper. And inevitably, you know, I took this project was, I think it was like a 3 or 4 months. Every time I'd go in the facility, I was live coding. So the youth had known me for a while, and then now, and I went from interacting and kind of like leading some sessions, but mostly our graduate students led, but it was mostly just, you know, my role is more, you know, building the relationships and getting to know the kids. And I went from that to now I'm just like this creepy guy in the corner, like circling things on a piece of paper. And for a note, we're on a Zoom and Kevin just laughed. So I won that. But anyway, so I had a youth come up to me and he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, you know, I kind of gave him like a Cliff Notes version of what I'm looking at. And he's like, what are you, like a creeper watching me like run around? Because I was actually coding him. Because I told him, I was like, look, you know, depending on, you know, are you walking, standing still, all this stuff. He's like, what are you, like checking out my ass? And I'm like, nope, definitely not doing that. But one of my other like favorite stories, this actually comes from, so we look at physical activity. We also look at fitness levels and we look at BMI and obesity rates. And honestly, that's to go back to kind of to loop into your previous question. not something I'm like uber interested in, but one of the things that I think when I think of Kevin now, like, you know, obviously the socialization stuff, but advocacy for physical education is something that I think always comes to mind. And one of the things that, like, I either learned from you, and I'm sure it's you and others, but it's, you have to advocate for, like, what you're doing. So, and also advocate for the kids. So a lot of the stuff that we're doing, because there's nothing out there, is showing how beneficial the work that we are doing within Project Flex is for the youth, and making sure that they're active, making sure that they're not gaining weight as at an inordinate rate. So one story that I had, so we have these youth do the pacer test every so often. And we had, most of these kids are pretty competitive, as am I. And I scored a pretty good, you know, I will sometimes like run with the kids to like demonstrate it or whatnot. And we had a youth that had the highest score on the pacer, right? It was like a 78 or something like that. It was like one of our higher scores. He was overly competitive. And I was explaining to him that I was like, you know, it's getting close to that time where we're going to have to run the pacer again. Sometimes they weren't thrilled about it. And I told him, I was like, look, if I'm here, like, I'm going to kick your ass in the pacer. And he looks at me and he's like, what'd you say to me? And I was like, yeah, the feast. And you're like, I'm going to kick your ass. And he starts to like size me up and he's like, you think you can kick my ass? And I'm like, yeah, it's not even a question. Like, I'm going to beat you in this. And he didn't realize that the running test was called the pacer test. He just thought I actually wanted to fight him and beat his ass. So, and he's a big, and again, like, I'm not like a physical person at all by any means, but and this kid could surely kick my ass. But he's like literally like sizing me up. And I'm like, look, like, I'm at the running test. And as soon as it like clicked for him, because he went to like, I'm about to fight this kid, to, like that. And then clicked to like, well, I'm still going to beat you in that too. And that's like one of the more PG stories that I have. That's more, we have a lot of good stories, as you can imagine.
Oh yeah.
But as like, that's a very like research based one that comes to me.
I'll
share one.
Go ahead. Yeah. Please. Yeah.
I'll share one. It's just a little, it's just a short one. So I mentioned earlier that, being inquisitive with the kids is sometimes tricky, especially because they might feel defensive. But I've been in this program long enough to where I have a reputation, where it's like, oh, Dr. J has so many questions all the time. Like, all she does is ask questions. And it's like a bit of like, I hate it, but it's like a little bit deep down, I think they love it too.
Yeah.
And it's not just research, but I just always have questions. I just like having them reflect. They like, no, that's what I'm all about. My two favorite words they know are goals and reflection. But there was one time where it was not a research day. We were not there for research reasons. And we were playing some game in the gym. And then I took a break and went to sit on the sideline, just like perched against the wall. And one kid who we'll call a pickleball superstar, he'll know who he is if he listens to this. But he came over and just like sat down next to me casually and didn't say anything. And neither did I, because I was going to wait for him to make his move, what he wanted. And it was quiet for maybe a minute, but I could feel there was that anticipation. And then he just like looks over me. He's like, dang, Dr. J, why haven't you asked me a question yet? And I'm like, well, you want me to ask a question? Sure. And I'm like, how's your day? He's like, no, you'd never ask that question. Ask like a real question, like a Dr. J question. And I'm like, okay, let's dive right in. And I'm like, talk to me about drugs. And then he just talked about all these different drugs for like, and we had an hour long conversation. He's like, well, then there's this one and this one. And I'm like, tell me more. And I think I say that like, cause I think it's comical, but also because I think that through our research, we're sort of teaching them that they actually are experts. And it doesn't really matter what they're experts on. You know, right. I don't think anybody would maybe brag that they're experts on drugs. But he was so proud to be able to share, and not necessarily from his own usage, but just being exposed to that type of world. Here's this, and this is what this means. And you've never heard of this one. And this is what this means. And here's how much it costs. And here's how you sell it. And here is somebody with a PhD and somebody who dropped out of school in sixth grade. And the one who dropped out of school in sixth grade is eloquently speaking about a topic that he is an expert on and sharing it with confidence. And it was a conversant thing where we're going back and forth. And so I love that story. I love that the kids can feel safe around us and our team and want to share things and have that empowering feeling that they're the expert on something.
Yeah, yeah. So a couple times now, as you've spoken on the podcast, and this is maybe a hard question that I'm formulating in my head on the run, so forgive me. But I've sensed, and I'm not sure if I'm using language right, I've sensed an air of advocacy in your words for these young people. And I wonder if that's intentional, and if you see that as one and the same as both your service and the research you're doing. So is that, you know, like action research or emancipatory type research where you're intentionally trying to advocate for these populations that nobody else, as you put before, is advocating for?
I think that's like a really beautiful way of making it sound like more important than what we're doing. If I'm speaking really candidly, I think that we're advocating for them as just an individual, maybe less as the population, but like Zach and I've seen him in action doing it. He isn't as inquisitive as me or invasive as me about questions, but he loves to ask, like, what's it like in here? What's the food like? What do you do when you wake up? What do you, you know, he loves asking just about their days. And he's so candid with them. Like, we don't know this stuff. You guys are the ones that live this and get to share this, and you hold that power and knowledge. And I think at like a very granular level, we want them to feel like capable people that holds their experiences as a way to teach others, just like that's what we do as professors. We hold our experiences to teach others. We just kind of went through different educational systems. Like, you can use they went through the School of Hard Knocks and we went through the university setting. And so I do think we are advocating for them to feel like real people. And yeah, I hate that that's something that needs to be advocated for to anybody, because of course they're real people. But time and time again, we return back to, and this is starting to emerge in some of our research, some of their most powerful moments are the ones that they feel like they're like a peer at NIU too. Like when they come to campus, their best, most memorable moments are the ones where they're standing in line at the dining hall and one of the students says to them, "Hey, is that fried chicken good?" And they loved that moment because they got looked at like a normal 17-year-old instead of somebody who committed a crime.
Like a human being before anything else. Yeah, that's powerful stuff. That's powerful stuff, Jen. So we are just about out of time here. I hate to rush to closure, but there is one last thing I'd like to do, and this is the first time I've ever tried to do it with two guests. So it might be a little bit awkward and a little bit different, but let's embrace that awkwardness. So because we're trying to get to know the stories behind the research, it's fun to end with some rapid fire questions that help us get to know you a little bit better. I have six categories. Are you comfortable giving me your quickest response?
I almost want to give my response. Like, I almost want to answer for Zach and Zach answers for me.
You want to do that? You want to do that?
Let's do it.
Now, this will be interesting. I haven't done it this way before. Favorite color?
Purple.
Blue.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Favorite animal?
Dog.
That's right. Cat?
I don't really know.
You don't like animals. I actually
I have a 3-year-old or 1-year-old. So like right now, my favorite animal is probably like a penguin or something, just because she's like penguins or like a porcupine.
Michael Hemphill has one of the most memorable responses to that question. With full confidence, he answered duck.
Interesting.
Oh, Michael.
Okay, so favorite season of the year?
She's going to say fall.
Mm-hmm. Zach is going to say summer because of summer camp.
Summer. You know, you guys have been pretty good at favorite.
We spent a lot of time together.
Favorite place on earth?
Ooh, I'm going to say parents' lake house in Michigan.
Yeah, it was that or the pickleball court, which I think you probably would have gone to next.
Yeah.
I'm going to say for Zach, I'm going to say a sentimental one that you're not going to think, but I think it's actually the right answer. I know how much you love your family walks. Ooh. And so that's where my mind went.
That's a good one. My mind went to like location. So I was going to say Punta Cana, but that's a good one. That's a good answer.
Oh, it's fun. And I don't know that I intentionally do it this way, but at the end, when we do this rapid fire, this is where all the kind of personal and fun stuff comes out about people. And it's really interesting. So two more. Favorite food.
Favorite food. So for those of you that don't know Jen well, she's a vegan, which I also take full credit for because she was a vegetarian, but I would call her a vegan for multiple years until I did the whole 30. And for those of you that don't know me well, I am about as opposite of a vegan as you can get. Like, I try to avoid vegan-friendly foods. So it's some sort of a vegan, like, she also likes blue bananas, though. But I don't know, some sort of a vegan pizza.
Something like that. And just for the record, Zach, vegan food just means vegetables. So you the world, you avoid vegetables willingly.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. I would say his favorite food, I'm going to go with his wife's homemade pizza, or actually I happen to know his wife makes amazing tofu broccoli, and that is vegan and he enjoys that. So he doesn't avoid that food.
That's good.
That's fantastic. Last but not least, favorite thing to drink.
Fireball.
I wish you would have said tea. But yes, I do love Fireball. If we're going alcohol, well, Zach drinks two things. He drinks water or Jack and Coke. Those are the only things I've ever seen him drink in his entire life. So it's one of those two things.
So my family has a tradition. Every time we get together, either my dad or my cousin brings along a sleeve of Fireball nips. And at like what feels like the most inopportune time possible, he'll just crack them open and pass them out. And you just have to do it.
I happen to recall a specific study that the three of us collaborated on and that Fireball may have been involved. And I'm not sure if this will make it in the podcast, but I'm just going to mention that.
It played an integral role in data collection and analysis.
All right. You guys are so fun. This was great. Thank you so much for spending an hour with me. As a reminder, the article is that we used as the focal point here is Impressed with the Journal of Correctional Healthcare. Once that gets published, at least ahead of print, and it's posted online, we'll get the link in the show notes for this episode. Thank you again, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time.